All men equal, gringos and Mechs and whatever. When the piss call comes, right, fellas? So the Federales say okay, and Kesey goes off in the scrub. Out the corner of his eye, he sees a train easing over the siding on the tracks, coming around the bend slow. All ass, Roto-Rooter. Kesey plunges into the brush toward the tracks, thorns and razor leaves raking his legs, the light from the train shaking that weird, sick ochre cast over the spiky brush clumps. Thrashing through this shit, up against the side of the train, jumps up on top of a coupling, grabs a ladder to the top of the boxcar. Rain comes in a sudden sheet. Lightning breaks out, lighting up the whole scene and his body. Federales huffing and galumping through the scrub like comic movie Mexicans, popping buttons off their guts and screaming, "Oi! Pronto!" And then, "Ram!" The bastards are shooting at him. Mama don't allow no grass smoking in here. Testy out here on edges of professed belief. Blackness. Then Cosmo let him in on it for an instant with a flash of lightning. More huffing, harumping. Ram! Comic Latino cops, until the train picks up speed and he lies battened down to the top of the car heading off to somebody's edge city somewhere. Which turns out to be Guadalajara. He has no money on him, no grass, no nothing. He heads for the inevitable Mariachi Square, hunkers down in the dark, wet and shivering. Wonder do they tolerate gringo bums in this town. Daylight, a Mexican comes through the park and strikes up a conversation, speaks English. He is a slender guy in his 20s, very handsome, like a Valentino, almost feminine. Queer, offers to let Kesey rest up in his hotel room. Queer. So beat and shivering, he takes him up on it. The hotel is one step above a flop house, but clean. He has a neat little room, this Mario, a snug harbor. Go ahead, get some sleep. Kesey tries to fight off the sleep fantasy. Queer assault. But he falls asleep anyway. Wakes up a long time later, all intact. Mario is broke himself, but gets off a collect telegram to Manzanillo under Kesey's new alias, Sol Almande. Salamander, you understand, the beast that lives in fire. Wait around all day and the next, Mario being nothing but a totally sweet person. What's his game? Down to the Holy Telegrafo to pray. All the Huarache Telegrafo workers sitting around under fluttering leaves of telegrams piling up. Ay tiempo. You have to know how to approach them, says Mario. Goes upstairs in the telegrafo. Presently, the Huarache chief rummages through the whole heap for a message for the burning Almande, but nothing. Next morning, Kesey decides to risk it. Goes down to the American consulate as a poor, broke, grizzled, balding American fisherman stranded and got to get back to Manzanillo. A girl there, a Miss Hitchcock, gives him 27 pesos for third-class bus fare to Manzanillo, and he gets on, with Mario waving a sweet valedictory goodbye. That was your bummer, Kesey, not to understand that the pure, humble Mexican strain of sweetness, that was all that Mario was about, just a muy simpático human being. The bus ride was horrible, 18 hours of bouncing through the ratlands, half road and half no road, the ratlands, and yet so many open faces. They look at you just like a head, totally open, wanting to find something rather than hide something. Many piss stops, and Kesey can only struggle around grizzled, waiting for the driver to get on with it. Kesey is hungry and burnt out like a husk. About 10 hours out, they're stopped, and the driver walks back and stares at Kesey with the wide-open, simpatico look and gives him 6 pesos, just like that, without a word. Worth about 17 cents, but good for a tacos or such like, and walks on back to the front of the bus. A strange land, this ratland. Sometimes they know. There is hope. Not just for the super-aware elected few, but for the unsuspected multitudes who open up and look. They are waiting here in this ratland. Back in Manzanillo, and the adrenaline was flowing again. Hagen and Ramrod were salted away in jail. Like everything in Mexico, the jail scene was tough and soft at the same time. It was filthy, crawling with ticks, lice, scorpions, the whole scene. The food was filthy, too. But you could have anything you wanted to put down your gullet sent in, if you could pay for. From luscious enchilada meals to grass, speed, and acid. Hagen and Ramrod stayed delightfully high and miserable. In any case, Kesey began to feel like it was only a matter of time before they closed in. It wasn't so much the Mexicans he was worried about. The Mexicans were always ready to make a deal. It was the stateside zealots. The FBI body snatchers worried him. He knew about Morton Sobel, the atom spy, who suddenly turned up one day at a border town in the custody of an FBI agent, walking across the border with the feds. If the FBI can grab you in Mexico, physically, the Mexicans will play along with that, too. And the zealous, head-buff San Mateo County cops. Word was that San Mateo cops were taking their vacations in Mexico for no other reason than to go Kesey hunting and to make more fat headlines. La Casa Grande and the Rat Shack becoming steadily more uncool as first one head and then another showed up, with big comradely grins on, kids from California, even from New York, who had somehow learned where Kesey is. They always came on like naturally the pranksters would be shining with joy to see them, we holy few, we initiates of the acid scene, with the grins spilling out over the edge of their lower teeth. Obviously, it was a big thing on the acid scene in the States to know where Kesey is. That was being very inside the thing. Yeah, I saw Kesey down there. Then, various pranksters brought friends over, including girls, of course. And Paige struck up with a tall blonde girl, kind of a Danish maiden sort, whom they all called Doris DeLay. It was getting like La Honda, the tropical annex, La Honda in the Tropic of Cancer. People were bunked in and straggled all over the place, in the house, in the Rat Shack, on the bus. A girl named Jeannie got bit by a scorpion one night. Everybody woke up, and what to do? They pondered a while and decided to go with the flow, and they all went back to sleep. She survived. Kesey remained very permissive about the whole thing. Nobody got shunted off. Put my professed beliefs to the test. In any case, it was no longer possible to believe there was any semblance of secrecy about the whole fugitive movie now. It was just a matter of time, or lackadaisicality, The whole scene would get Kesey up tight, and he would get in a car and drive up on a bluff overlooking the ocean and smoke grass and watch the ocean. Like Black Mariah, come to think of it. Black Mariah was going through a private hell. Namely, she was lonely as hell. Lonely? One means, how could a truly out-front person feel lonely amid so many truly out-front people doing so many things together and getting high together all the time? Would Mountain Girl ever feel lonely? Would Mountain Girl ever feel desperate? It was unthinkable. Mountain Girl was sinked into this whole thing. She, Black Mariah, was probably the only person in the history of this whole thing to get lonely, in the prankster hierarchy. Prankster hierarchy? There wasn't supposed to be any prankster hierarchy. Even Kesey was supposed to be the non-navigator and non-teacher. Certainly everybody else was an equal in the Brotherhood, for there was no competition, there were no games. They had left all that behind in the straight world. But, call it a game or what you will, right now, among the women, Mountain Girl was first, closest to Kesey, and Faye was second, or was it really vice versa, and Black Mariah was maybe third, but actually so remote it didn't matter. Among the men there was Babs, always the favorite, and no games. But sometimes it seemed like the old personality game, looks, and all the old aggressive, outgoing charm, even athletic ability. It won out here like everywhere else. Yet, by and by, Black Mariah was a prankster. It was just there in the air, the fact that she was now a prankster. She had altered the flow, and not by accepting it either. Paige's girl, Doris DeLay, was going through the same thing. There was something she wanted to ask somebody, but how could she ask it? Finally, she came up to Sandy Lehman Haupt and said, "What do they mean? Never trust a prankster." Chapter 25. Secret Agent Number 1. Afternoon. Paige comes busting in La Casa Grande saying, "Hey, there's a guy across the road taking pictures of us." Sure enough, there was a guy peeking over the edge of a window in an unfinished cottage across the beach road, another cinder block rat wonder. The sun highlights off his camera lens. Kesey gets the adrenaline pumping for a run, but Paige charges across the road to the cottage like he owns the place, followed shortly by Babs. Inside the cottage he finds a Mexican dressed like a businessman, metallic suit, white shirt and tie, looks like he's in his 30s. "What the hell do you think you're doing?" says Paige. "Hello, amigo," the guy says, looking fairly cool. He speaks English. "I think maybe I'd buy this house. You like the beach here?" "Yeah, yeah, right, says Babs. Babs has his friendly put-on grin turned up to such maximum intensity, the guy flinches his cool momentarily, but he gets it back. "Yes?" "Yeah, yeah, right. "Yes, I'm glad. I like another person's opinion in these things. Well, So long, amigos. And he steps outside like he's going. Send us some pictures if they turn out good, says Babs. Some pictures? Yeah, right. What pictures? Of us. We like pictures. We have a whole scrapbook. We like candid pictures, you know. I bet you took some good ones. Yes. The Mexican looks very thoughtful. I tell you, friend, maybe you can help me. Yeah, right. I am with the Mexican Naval Intelligence, and maybe you can help us. We have reports of Russian submarines operating in these waters. Submarines, says Babs in total put-on wonderment. Several pranksters have gathered in front of La Casa Grande to watch Babs and Paige and the Mexican outside the rat cottage. Yes, says the Mexican. We have reports that these submarines are coming in to shore at night in these waters. Have you noticed any such activity? Notice, says Babs. Well, I reckon by Christ we have. You ought to come out here some night. Some nights there's so goddamn many of them you can't go to sleep for the signal lights. Shine right in the windows, blinking something fierce, and it's a tough code. A tough code, but we'll break it yet. We got a lot of good heads working on it. Why, this fellow right here, pointing to Paige and rattling on about the incredible brazen activity of the Russian submarines in these waters, while Cassidy comes across the road, flipping his sledgehammer, singles, doubles, triples, way up in the air, looping it, catching it behind his back, and so on, but not looking at them for a second. Cassidy sets a brick up on a fence about 15 feet from the Mexican, but doesn't say a word or even look, ratcheting his arms and legs this way and that to his private Joe Cuba. Then he heads back across the road. Yes, says the Mexican. Please, may I ask you this? We have a report on one of these Russian who maybe was landing here from a submarine. He is about 5'11". He is a muscular man. He looks about 30 years old. He has blonde hair. His hair is curly, and he is a little bald on the top. Have you seen any such person? One of these Russians, says Babs. Have you been to Eat Alley? Eat Alley? Yeah, right. The marketplace. All you hear in the marketplace is Russian. They're all over the place. This thing is wide open already, man. The guy cocks his head and stares at Babs through his shades, as if maybe this will bring him into focus. Just then, pew, whop! Cassidy, 20 feet away across the beach road, has suddenly wheeled and fired the 4-pound sledgehammer end over end like a bolo and smashed the brick on top of the fence into obliteration 15 feet from the Mexican. Yes, says the Mexican. Thank you, friend. And he wheels and walks off at a good clip down the road and gets into a sedan and hauls out of there. The next day, however, the little dude is back walking along the beach road with a bounce, so Babs goes out to meet him. Amigo, the guy says, have you seen any Russians today? This with a big sparkling grin, as if to say it's all been a grand joke among us fellows who are in on it. So Babs thinks it over and says, let's go up to the Polynesian Palace and have a talk about the whole thing, man to man. So the Mexican says okay, and they head up toward town toward a Polynesian restaurant up the way. Well, that gets the guy away from La Casa Grande, at least. Keezy has been primed for this, ready to make a run for it in one of the cars. He could head for the jungle, but the jungle is such a total bummer. On the other hand, the road out is no bargain either. If they are really closing in, they could have Route 15 bottled up so fast he'd never make it. Well, get out of La Casa Grande in any case. So he and Stone get into Stone's car and drive up to the bluff overlooking the ocean and have a couple of tokes to assess the situation. They park up on the bluff and look down at the festering red tide. The fucking festering red tide. They turn the situation this way and that, and then Keezy decides. It is no use running either into the jungle or up the road. That's their game, the cops and robbers game. That's their movie. And they know their movie backward and forward. And they know how that one comes out, and we know how it comes out. Justice triumphs after a merry chase, and the fugitive eats dung dust in the last reel to show the horror of his dope fiend ways. The only way out is to make it the prankster movie, and imagine this metallic little dude into the prankster movie. There's no one to run to say, Mommy, this movie is no fun anymore, it's too real, Mommy. Up tight against the professed beliefs, Major, and you better believe, or else draggle your ass inaudible. They get to talk about fugitive movies they have seen in which the fugitive wins out. And they hit upon Casablanca, the Humphrey Bogart picture. Bogart was a fugitive in Casablanca in the Moroccan desert, operating a restaurant during World War II, aiding and abetting resistance fighters from Europe. And the Nazi type, or Vichy France type FBI man, the cop heavy in any case, comes in to question him. "Why did you come to Casablanca?" he says. "For the waters," says Bogart. "There is no water here," says the cop heavy. "We are in the middle of the desert." "Oh," says Bogart, "I was misinformed." There it is, the movie. So Stone and Kesey drive back and join Babs and the Mexican dude in the Polynesian bar. The Mexican dude and Babs have been having quite a time. 6 or 8 beer bottles are on the table, and the Mexican dude is waxing very high and expansive, gesturing grandly, urging them to sit down and carrying on. He wants to know Kesey's name, and Kesey says Sol Almonde. Babs has given him a shucked name of his own, and Stone says he is from Esquire magazine. He studies an expense voucher from Esquire that Stone has as if it is a highly suspicious document. Then he whips out his billfold from inside his coat and flips it open, displaying a big badge with the number 1 on it. "What's that?" says Babs.
"That? I am agent numero uno."
"Secret agent number 1, says Babs.
"Yeah, yeah, right, right, right," says agent number 1, drawing his head back and taking an angle on Babs.
It is like a cross between Zorro and Nero. Then he goes into a history of his famous cases.
"Elizabeth Taylor is coming to Mexico City. See? That is my case. I know her very well. See? I am going around to her hotel, and she has all these people."
"Ah." He turns his hands up and pulls his chin down under his collarbone as if to say it is doubtful they could even comprehend how many people she has. "All these functionaries doing this and doing that, in the corridor outside even, and one of them, this big maricón," meaning queer, "he tells me, 'No one can go in, no one.'"
"No one, eh?" I tell him. "He is a big maricón. I can tell. There is a look they have, these maricons. They have cojines the size of habichuelas. One can see it in the face, in the voice. They are soft like sheep, these maricons." "Maricón," I say to him. His voice, he just oops, you know, like a little thing of water. "Out of my way, maricón."
Agent number 1 half leaps out of his chair with the reenactment, his eyes bouncing off his shades, shooting up like he is galvanized with 1,000 volts. Then he sinks back.
"Well," he says very softly, and smiles like someone getting ready to drop off to sleep.
The way he says it, you can see the maricón collapsing, dissolving, turning into little driblets of jelly and opening the door to Miss Taylor's suite. There is no stopping Agent number 1 now. Exploit after exploit bubbles up in his brain. Cornered like a rat, he faces them down. About to be cut down in fusillades, he whips his revolver and fires one shot. One shot, amigo, and that takes care of that. The sons of beaches think they have him outsmarted, ready to make their move, and he has already made his move and is waiting for them like a bucket under a faucet, and so on. The strange thing, however, is that none of these fabulous cases has anything to do with celebrities. They're all marijuana cases, usually involving Americans. Yes. Finally, he takes out his camera and takes a picture of each of them. Kesey says, "Why don't you come to our party tomorrow night? A lot of people will be there."
"Your party?"
"Yeah, we're having a farewell party tomorrow night."
"Farewell?"
"Yeah, we're leaving Mexico and going back up to California, so we're giving a farewell party."
"Well, thank you, amigo. I will be there."
So began the first Mexican acid test. Agent number 1 wasn't the most brilliant cop in the Americas, but time was obviously running out in old Mexico. It was time to get the movie going on all projectors. And the bus. The new fantasy was to get on the bus and keep moving, roam through Mexico and give acid tests, and be on the bus, keeping the prankster movie going at top speed at all times. They held the Manzanillo test in the courtyard of Babs Rat Shack under the aegis of the Purina Chow. It was a small one, with all random heads in the area welcome. No Grateful Dead, of course, so they gave the Polynesian restaurant Latino Combo $10 to come down the road and play during their intermissions. Between times, the pranksters themselves furnished the music, rolling all the fantastic coils of wire out with Gretsch on the organ and movies and lights and all the rest. The night was full of heat lightning, which was nice, and the prankster musicians squealed their weird Chinese tones, wailing electronically in the rat netherlands. But no secret agent numero uno. Kesey actually hoped the guy would turn up. He was just crazy enough to be adaptable for the movie. He was a creature of fantasy himself. In any case, better him there gathering more data for his fabulous career than lurking in the cocoa palms working himself up to spring his ultimate cop fantasy on them. Well, if so, they would go out freaking and wailing on the shores of the red tide. The Polynesian players came down the road again and played. It was nice to get freaked into Latino syncopation. Then a lull, and then the shit. Oi! Pronto! This piping shout from the other side of the rat shack. And where have I heard that cry before, Cosmo? Oi! Pronto! And all veer stroked out waiting for the pounce. More pounce to the ounce in a Mexican bust. Well, let's have it. Let's see the federales do their fantasy to mariachis, breaking on the high notes and struggling up again and huffing and galumphing with gold butts and stars in their teeth. Oi! Pronto! Come on in, fellas. It's strictly Dutch freak here inside. And around the corner comes only the owner of the Polynesian Palace, pissed off because his combo was hung up on the crazies here long past intermission, and he has enough problems in the red tide doldrums without them malingering with the crazies. Oi, pronto, he keeps shouting. Hurry up, get your asses back to the store. Prodding and herding them out of the Purina Chow Palace delirium. Oi, pronto. The heat freak lightning flashes crazy enough, and it is a good sign. The movie is going. The pranksters pulled out of Manzanillo the next day without a word or a move from Agent Number One, big as life on the bus, plus a small caravan of cars. They headed to Guadalajara and gave an acid test in a restaurant there. The test went on two nights, and each night a well-dressed Mexicano with the gleaming nighttime Mexico white shirt over his staunch midriff turned up with a go-go girl and stayed right through, although they didn't take acid, smiled and danced and seemed to enjoy themselves. Turned out he was the local jefe of detectives. We are not alone. The bus tooled into Aguas Calientes, 364 miles northwest of Mexico City, loaded for acid tests. Aguas Calientes is 6,000 feet up in Tierras Frescas, with a paradise climate in late summer, a nicely weird city, built above a vast system of tunnels by an unknown race, pranksters in the time warp of many millennia ago. Suddenly, Sandy was immensely enthusiastic. Sandy had packed his motorcycle onto the bus. He was getting more and more robust day by day, all for this Mexican adventure. "The mineral springs," said Sandy. "You gotta try them." A warm, soothing mineral spring bath, soaking late summer paradise into every bone. Cleanliness is next. Aguas Calientes was what all these Tierras del Fuego were piled up rock by rock for, this little bit of heaven in the upper altitudes. Mountain Girl listened to all this and she knew. Well, that would be that. They would hang around Aguas Calientes the rest of the day. If there was one thing Kesey couldn't resist, it was the prospect of a long, warm soak. He would stay in a warm tub 1 hour any time, and the paradisaical Aguas Calientes were good for 4 or 5 hours easy. So Kesey and many pranksters went off and immersed up to their chops in the warm springs. Hagen was delegated to stay behind and watch the bus and all the acid test equipment inside. Sandy went off to take a spin on his motorcycle. Presently, Sandy turned back up at the bus. He looked most big and bright. He had on an orange jacket, gleaming day-glow, and much orange day-glow on his bike, and was looking strong. Sandy climbed up in the bus and went back in there, and presently he emerged, carrying the big Ampex. "What are you doing with that?" says Hagen. "I need something heavy to put on the back of my bike for a test run," says Sandy. "I'm going to be carrying a lot of stuff back to New York, and I want to find out how much I can maneuver with on this thing." "Well, I don't know," says Hagen. "Man, there's something wrong with this. Prankster equipment isn't supposed to leave the bus. You know what the chief says." "It's not leaving the bus," says Sandy. "I just want to take it down a few blocks to see how the bike handles with a weight on it." All the time, Sandy is tying the huge clump of equipment down on the back rider's seat of the bike. It's so heavy and bulky, it doesn't look like he could make 10 miles with it. "I don't think you should," says Hagen. "I'll be right back," says Sandy, and he guns on off with the bike drooping in the back. An hour goes by, 2 hours, and he isn't back. Hagen is worried. Then Kesey shows up back from the baths. "Let's go," says Kesey. He sees the whole thing right away, the fateful Ampex that Sandy had hassled over a year ago. Some bitch has split. They jump in a car and take off up the highway north toward Zacatecas. He has a big start, but he won't be getting very far with that back end loaded down like it is. They go barreling through the Coca-Cola and Carta Blanca crossroads of old Mexico, up past Chicalote and Rincón de Romos and San Francisco, everywhere stopping and shouting at the Mex drugstore cowboys on the corner. "Hey, have you seen a crazy gringo on a motorcycle all dressed in orange?" "No." No, no. The bastards, they're too battened down in their huaraches to say so anyway, and they barrel on up through the dung dust, but finally give up and trail on back to the bus. Shit, says Mountain Girl, that Ampex is the guts of the acid test. The whole complicated thing of the instruments, the variable lag, the synchronicity, the taping for the archives, they can't do it without the Ampex. Sandy has taken the prankster Ampex. To the pranksters, there was not the slightest doubt in the world that the equipment was the pranksters. Not prankster Sandy Lehman Haupts, but the pranksters. The prankster family, the prankster order, superseded all straight world ties, contracts and chattel laws, and who was my mother or my brethren? And he looked round about on them which sat about him, and said, Behold my mother and my brethren, for whosoever shall do the will of God, the same is my brother and my sister and my mother. And there was nothing left but the vision of the sumbitch tooling up the Mexican National Highway, struggling on his Suzuki to haul possessions back to New York. New York! So this was what he had built up the strength for. 6,000 freaking miles on a 250-pound motorcycle to seek out his electronic chattel and draggle it back, freaking day-glow in the sundown toward the border. About 4,500 feet away, Sandy rested in the shadow behind a big corrugated tin shed. Out in the open sun there, the runway of the Aguas Calientes airport with brown Mexicans in coveralls lollygagging around. Sandy had been a man of his word, up to a given point, so to speak. He had gone a couple of blocks, like he said. Then he took a right and rode on over to the city airport and parked behind the shed, and waited. And was Kesey really so far into now, such a master of precognition, that he would shoot the Zen arrow? Or let him draw it, rather, and come straight there and hassle him upside the bus again, and in that moment let him know irrevocably who was the power, the control over his mind forever? Strangely, the paranoia lasted only for a twinge as he caught his breath in the shade. In fact, he was strangely calm, as if the chase were now over, rather than begun. He had done it. It had been his movie. He had drawn them into his scenario. Mike Hagen. Well, he had said, I don't know. You know what the chief says. He knew. He had been on the bus for 3 years. The trip had been liberation and captivity all at the same time. Liberation, power, will, the greatest in the world. And whose will? The group mind's? Well, he had never had a dream war with the group mind. He had never been held in thrall by the group mind. He had never been subject to absolute judgment by the group mind, waiting for the one cryptic word that will say, It's okay, Sandy. Naturally, he could never haul the big Ampex 3,000 miles on a motorcycle. It would be a little pile of gleaming whimsy like one of Paul Foster's acid bag transistor radios by the time he reached the border, from the interminable bouncing. But he had that figured out. There was a railway express agency in Aguas Calientes. He would take the Ampex over there and ship it to New York Collect and ride back on the motorcycle free as a bird. Which he did. A year later, I talked to Sandy in Central Park, down by the edge of the lake near Central Park South. He looked good. Strong, calm. He was going with a good-looking blonde whom I had met. He had a job as a sound engineer with one of the recording companies. We got to talking for a long time about his adventures with the pranksters, and dusk came on, and we related what we had each heard of Kesey recently. And in all of it, Sandy spoke with warmth about Kesey, about the whole experience, with no traces of rancor. It started getting dark, and we got up and walked out of the park. Just before we parted, Sandy turned to me and said, You know, I'll always be on the bus. Leo. Leo. You are Leo, aren't you? Do you not know me anymore? We were league brothers together and should still be so. We were both travelers on the journey to the east. The pranksters moved on to Mexico City and environs, giving a couple of acid tests, but without any astounding gusto. American heads from the Ajijic San Miguel de Allende, Mexico City circuit, gathered proudly. Yeah, I ran into Kesey and the pranksters in Mexico, and we all got stoned. A few Indians came and got taciturnly freaked. Meanwhile, Kesey's lawyers were hassling with Mexico City immigration legals in Mexico City to see about getting him a proper visa for a long haul. And they blew hot and cool, and then cooler and cooler. They seemed to be followed, the pranksters and the bus, by carloads of well-dressed Mexican dudes here and there. Stone saw more than anyone else, but kept driving. Cassidy, hauling the bus over the Mexico Tierras Frias with his new goal up against now of going the length and breadth of Mexico without using the brakes and without stopping for anything, hauling off onto crumbling scrub root shoulders rather than stop for carts or cars or animals, smoothing out his stroke from the Joe Cuba spastokinetic jerk, the sudden straight lines into a new line, the new line. Kesey can see it happening even in the eternal Cassidy. But of course, in him first of all, from fire to water, from the Stone Age into the Acid Age, and in a moment, now, further. Hall asked Kesey. It was now time to bring the future back to the USA, back to San Francisco, and brazen it out with the cops and whatever else there. The Mexican legals were hinting at booting him out, maybe in a month, on the technicality of no visa. But the ratlands were spent anyway. They had junked it through on the fabulous junk of Mexico. They had gorged it up. They had, in truth major, there were no more spas to water at in the ratlands. The current fantasy was to take the outlaw prank to its ultimate, be a prankster fugitive extraordinaire in the Baskin-Robbins bosom of the USA. You have never seen a prankster fugitive? Now watch that movie, draws you right in. Kesey had a good melodrama for going back in. Paint it big enough and bright enough and they will never see you. He figured to sneak back in on the purloined letter principle. If you are gross enough about the whole thing, they will never know it's you. Kesey picked Brownsville, Texas for the re-entry. It was the easternmost entry point on the Mexican border, practically on the Gulf of Mexico, and the least likely spot for heads to pick to go back in at. Most of the heads used the western end, the Tijuana end, because they were going back to California. So he put on a cowboy hat, and just before the U.S. Customs and Immigration Station at Brownsville launched into view, he rented the Mexican's swayback white horse and got on with his cowboy hat cocked on crazily, playing a guitar and lolling his head around like he was drunk. He came across the border lurching along on an old white horse as Singing Jimmy Englund. How long you been in Mexico? Too damn long. May I see your visa? I don't have it. Where is it? Visa? How the hell did he know? Came down to play a country and western show in that fucking Matamoros. And be damned if they didn't get him drunk, them fucking Mexes, their fucking women and their margaritas. And they rolled his ass in the streets of Matamoros, took his money and his papers, cleaned him out. And he got drunker and he stayed drunker in this goddamned Mexico, bricked up his bowels with terracotta. And him just a good old boy from Boise, Idaho, and that's where he's going back. No more Mexico, no more Las Vegas. Have you got any identification? All I got's this here. And he shows the brown trooper a credit card, Bank of America, reading James C. Englund, Las Vegas, Nevada. So they led him across, and he headed down the road clawing on the guitar and lolling around on the back of the horse, although they retrieved the horse from him. Can't let any disease sneak across the border from the ratlands, you understand. Singing Jimmy Englund started thumbing out in the dust with his rat tar under the other arm. Chapter 26. The Cops and Robbers Game. Singing Jimmy, hocking horse and phlegmy, sticks his grizzle in the dust muck Brownsville drizzle, starts to thumbing up the Texas belly bumming. He the cops and robbers game. Lone superhero, superhighway Cosmo hero, never lies. Honesty's the best disguise in the cops and robbers game. See, cop fellas, freaked out, head buff, circosparellas. Here's my rat tar and my buckskin cowboy suit. Prankster red boots from Guadalajara. My cowboy hat shows you where I'm at in the cops and robbers game. I ain't Clark Kent. I ain't Steve Lamb. Popeye the Sailor, I am what I am in the cops and robbers game. Came a car. Didn't take him very far in the cops and robbers game. At the wheel in this fucked up dust muck hitchhike deal was a Mississippi kite with a smile of ebonite. Inchy road, heavy duty, heavy load in the cops and robbers game. Shit. The Cosmo Kid, he split at the coffee light eggs looking at your bus depot, on the bus, in the cops and robbers game. Greyhound humid, most mightily piss fumid, all the way to Salt Lake City, on the bus, in the cops and robbers game. Oh, riding second class with shock absorbers up my ass reminds me of the FBI's left behind me, out front, superhero of the cops and robbers game. Took a flight to San Francisco late at night. Cop alert for hero in a buckskin shirt, cocked to shoot. That super dude in red dude boots? Not hardly. Official mind destroyer, this prankster suit of flaming Orlon paranoia. Hardly visible, this risible cowboy. Cardiac drummer, marching to a different bummer in the cops and robbers game. From the airport, with creamy prankster pudding escorts, Neil and Hugh, Dayglo Marvel comic crew, commence the movie. Freak the cops. Shuck the narcos. Shuck the feds. Shuck the San Mateo sheriff. Shuck the San Francisco chief. Shuck the judges in their chambers. We shall not flag nor fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall shuck you on the beaches. We shall shuck you on the landing grounds. We shall shuck you in the fields, in the streets, on the hills, and in the trees. Groovy plot. Hot movie in these trees. See the very hunted coons. Salt J. Edgar Hoover's wounds. Yeah, the cops and robbers game. Kesey holds up at his old friend Blank's house in Palo Alto. He is in a strange state of mind. He is in the cops movie now, the cops and robbers game, and eventually they will win because it is their movie. Gotcha. Unless he makes it his movie, which will take the utmost risk and daring. Here I am, boys. In the cops and robbers game, you creep and skulk about in a state of tachycardia, and they like to think of you in your reptile misery. So, break skulk. In short, the fantasy is now to become a kind of day-glow pimpernel, popping up here and there, right out in public, then vanishing, wreaking legend in the wake. He will be like one of those movie criminals who send florid-coded notes to the police about au pair girls he intends to garrote, and then does it, while all the world pants for next week's broken hyoid bone. Only he hasn't been strangling, merely smoking grass. You would never know that, however, from the excitement in San Francisco. A strange sort of guest to have in the house, and hardly knows what to make of the performance, Kesey veering wildly from paranoia and hyper-security to extraordinary disregard for his own safety, one state giving way to the other in no fixed order. Kesey gets up about noon or 1 p.m., eats, then goes out in the garden out back and sits there in his buckskin shirt playing a prankster flute. If one plays anything much more bizarre than a transistor radio out back in the garden in Palo Alto, it amounts to freaking insurrection, let alone a big muscular mountain man in a buckskin shirt playing a flute. Then, at night, a few tokes here, a few tokes there, it adds up. Major, Kesey, and a prankster or two start to rapping, gently. Rapping, cortex-tapping, rat-tat-tatting, tatter-ratting, fooling, puling, ululation, skeel-goose-screeling, glossolalia, crested screamers, megascops, bust the eardrums, freak the cops. Until by 2 a.m. the house would be reeling with enough rat-tars, loon cries, tapes, and howling grass euphoria to wake up all of sweet dream tunnel Palo Alto for the next 15 years. But then suddenly at 4 a.m. or 5, after outlasting everyone in the mad howl, Kesey would suddenly decide it was time for maximum security precautions, and would disappear into the cellar to a snug nest behind the packing cases in the cobwebs. Well, at least the bastards wouldn't get him with Gestapo tap on the shoulder. All right, Kesey. That movie. But then awaking and starting his movie almost at once. Neil, Hugh Romney, Kesey, and a small detachment of Hell's Angels head for a 3-day trips festival in progress at San Francisco State College, Saturday night, October 1st. The seeds one has sown. The acid tests have already caught hold in the college world. San Francisco State has become the acid head's true universitas, sort of the way Ohio State is for football freaks. They are trying the whole thing, the acid test, with the utmost faithful eclecticism. Alpha, beta, delta hand a poker. Movies at the smoker. Collegiate. Donkey beads, temple bells, sandals and mandalas. Psychedelic. The Hell's Angels are riding shotgun for the fugitive. They like this. They can freak out any approaching cops in cruiser or battalion. For some suitable weird reason, all the lights are left on in the campus buildings. The festival is in the gymnasium, full of scaffolding and people sweeping the ceilings with movies and light projections, control towers. and the Grateful Dead on the bandstand, all careful homage to the original acid tests. And then suddenly, Keezy will be there, broadcasting into the gymnasium from a campus radio station. A very tight ship, this fantasy, even up to Hell's Angels standing guard outside the studio. Except that by the time they get all the wiring hooked up and start rapping, Cassidy, with a microphone inside the hall, introducing Ken Keezy! It is about 4 a.m. Keezy is hidden in the studio, talking over the hugest prankster hookup of wires running long over the college campus to the gymnasium. Freewheeling Frank, the Hell's Angel, zonked on acid, barges into the studio and sees Keezy there sitting on a stool with an electric guitar and wires running all around his legs and his neck, branging on the guitar, rapping poetry into the microphone with fluorescent light and on-the-air sign filling up the room. The god of LSD. He's so wired up it scares me. This god reminds me of a satellite that flies around in the skies. Whereupon Frank hugs him and feels an immediate surge of electricity and sits down on the floor and starts playing a harmonica, and Keezy raps on for the benefit of the hundreds watching the swirling light shows in the gymnasium. You who stand, sit, and crawl around, and about the floor about you, and above you on the ceiling, that madness that's running in color is your brain. And then he stalks out of the room. He's mad because he has not captured my mind, thinks Frank. He has so many million minds that he has captured that not even a smile is left on his face. But there were no millions or even hundreds left in the gymnasium because it was so late it was down to a group of hardcore heads, many of whom were so high they were used to all sorts of time and geography warps. Everything was real. Money, Madame Blavatsky's Johann Maya, Ken Keezy broadcasting over the PA system. Keezy finally comes out and walks through the residue, but they are all whacked out and he is hardly visible, in his prankster suit of flaming Orlan paranoia. Nevertheless, the word is now out among the heads of Haight-Ashbury. Keezy is back, the man, the Castro who won them what they have today in the first place. The seeds we have sown. Down in Ratland, red-tide Manzanillo, Keezy and the pranksters had been so cut off they got almost no news from San Francisco. It was all perfect Devil's Island down there. They had only a dim idea of what was going on among the heads in Haight-Ashbury. But now, like, you don't even have to look for it. It hit you in the face. It's a whole carnival. All you have to do is walk up into the Haight-Ashbury, and Keezy chances a run through. Hell, in Haight-Ashbury, a muscular guy in cowboy boots and a cowboy hat, he looks healthy. The cops are busy trying to figure out these new long hairs, these beatniks. These crazies are somehow weirder than the North Beach beatniks ever were. They glow blue like a TV tube. The hippy-dippies, their Jesus hair. Men with hair falling down to the shoulders and beards to their chest, all lank and thin and limp like lungers. Sergeant, they're lollygagging up against the storefronts on Haight Street up near that psychedelic shop like somebody hucked a bunch of TB lungers up against the windows and they've oozed down to the sidewalk, staring at you with these huge zombie eyes, just staring. And a lot of weird American Indian and Indian from India shit, beaded headbands and donkey beads and temple bells. And the live ones promenading up and down Haight Street in costumes or half-costumes like some kind of a doorman's coat with piping and crap, but with blue jeans for pants and mod boots. The cops, oh, how it messed up their minds. The cops knew drunks and junkies by heart, and they knew about LSD, but this thing that was going on. The heads could con the cops blind, and it was wild. Haight-Ashbury had always been a brave little tenement district up the hill from the Panhandle entrance to Golden Gate Park, with whites and Negroes living next door in peace. Rents had been going up in North Beach. A lot of young couples with bohemian enthusiasms had been moving to Haight-Ashbury. Some of the old beats had moved in. They hung around a place called the Blue Unicorn. But the Trips Festival of 8 months before was what really kicked the whole thing off. 8 months, and all of a sudden it was like the acid tests had taken root and sprung up into people living the tests like a whole lifestyle. The Grateful Dead had moved into a house in Haight-Ashbury. And it wasn't just the old communal living where everybody piled into some place. They lived it prankster style, as a group with a name and a mission, which was music and the psychedelic vision. Yes, a thin, almost caved-in guy with incredible freaking light brown Jesus hair and beard flowing all over him, and round wire-rimmed spectacles, named Chet Helms, had a group called the Family Dog. They also lived it prankster style in a garage at 1090 Page, holding rock and roll dances amid a lot of Indian cymbals. They had taken part in the Trips Festival. Helms was a head, but a very practical head. He saw it coming with the Trips Festival the whole wave. He started an ongoing Trips Festival every week, selling tickets at a ballroom, the Avalon, at Van Ness and Sutter. Bill Graham, the impresario for the Trips Festival, was into the thing, too, and had a Trips Festival scene going in the Fillmore Auditorium, a dance hall at Fillmore and Gary. Graham and Kesey had had a falling out at the Trips Festival itself over things like who was going to handle the gate, and it ended in a badass moment when Graham put out his hand to shake and make up, and Kesey just looked at it and walked away.